This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about President Trump's actions impacting Iran, Gaza, and North Korea.
World War II didn't happen immediately. It was steadily built up. Are these the steps towards World War III?
We'll speak with the author of a new book, Stories from Trailblazing Women Lawyers, Lives in the Law.
Women lawyers are a new phenomenon in America. When I went to law school, and the school bragged about this, there were only 5% women in my class. Now about half the bar constitutes women.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Heidi, Dee Dee Hallock, Joel Covell's comrade and companion and wife for many years, wrote a beautiful obituary when Joel died on April 30th this year. Would you please read it?
Joel Covell passed away at St. Luke's Hospital in New York City on April 30th, 2018. He suffered from pneumonia and autoimmune encephalitis. In the 1960s and 70s, Dr. Covell was a well-known psychiatrist and teacher. He was director of resident training in psychiatry at Albert Einstein Medical School and had enormous influence on a generation of young psychiatrists. His first book, White Racism, was a prescient and detailed look at the persistent and deeply embedded racism that is ever present in U.S. society. As he became active in the movement against the Vietnam War and nuclear proliferation, he could not continue to work in what he felt was a burgeoning pharma corporate medicine. He left Einstein to teach Marx and Freud, first at the New School and then at Bard College, where he held the Alger Hiss Chair of Social Science. His book, Overcoming Zionism, has been an important primer for the movement to support Palestinian rights. Starting in the 1990s, Covell's work turned to ecology and global warming. Although not a climate scientist, he was an early predictor of climate change. He was editor of the journal Capitalism, Nature, Socialism, and was a public intellectual through his finely honed, passionate articles and panel participations throughout the United States and Europe. He co-authored with Michael Lowy the influential Eco-Socialist Manifesto, which founded the eco-socialist movement. His many books have been published in the United States, Turkey, and China. Covell ran for the U.S. Senate in New York for the Green Party in 1998 and ran for U.S. President against Ralph Nader in the Green Party primary in 2000. Covell was an avid scholar of William Blake. The title of his memoir, which he completed in 2017, is a quote from Blake, "The Lost Traveler's Dream." Michael, Joel was a dear friend of Law and Disorder.
Yes, he was on our program several times, and I'll talk about that because it had to do with the suppression of his book, Overcoming Zionism. But I had met him before he wrote that book, about 20 years ago, when he was running for Senate in New York State. And my son was at a progressive high school called Elizabeth Irwin, which was the high school of the Little Red Schoolhouse, which in those days was still a little bit red.
Right.
And I asked the principal if it would be okay if Joel came and addressed the student body on his Senate candidacy. The principal agreed. Joel showed up. And he talked about how if people are going to free themselves, they really have to do it themselves. Nobody's going to do it for you, and we need our own political party as an instrument to do that. And boy, those students paid attention. It was amazing. So I got to be friends with Joel, and then 7 years later, he wrote the book Overcoming Zionism, which, if you're only to have one book about what's going on in Palestine and Israel and the Middle East, that's the book to have. A really fine book. It was published by Pluto Press and distributed by the University of Michigan. Well, the Zionists in Michigan got wind of the book, and they got the University of Michigan to suppress not only that book, but all of Pluto Press's books.
Wow.
We formed a committee called the Committee for Open Discussion of Zionism, and we were able, actually, to restore Pluto Press to its former status at the University of Michigan. We won that fight. 2 years later, Joel was let go. as a professor at Bard College, I think in large part because of that book. We never really could prove it. But in any case, Joel was not that unhappy about it because he went on to do other work. He wrote a great book called The Enemy of Nature. He always had the ability to go right to the heart of a problem. And the problem in the Middle East is Zionism. The problem with climate disaster is that the Earth has finite resources and capitalism needs to grow, like Joel compared it to a cancer. And the two come in conflict and you have what we have today. With losing Joel at age 81, we really lose a central thinker in our movement. You can Google him. He wrote 11 books altogether. Get a hold of his book on Zionism, his book on the environment, and let's keep Joel's work going.
Iran and Gaza are both at critical and potentially catastrophic junctures. Iran faces new challenges because of Donald Trump's denunciation of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran and the reimposition of sweeping sanctions. The sanctions will restrict Iran's energy exports and isolate its struggling banks. Foreign companies doing business in Iran will have to close down operations or risk U.S. Treasury sanctions. With Trump's opening of the United States Embassy in Jerusalem, we've seen a bloody Israeli massacre in Gaza and the promise of months of continued violence by Israel. An element within the Republican Party, with most of the money, is the Republican Jewish Committee. They support Netanyahu and his Likud party. The RJC supported both the blowing up of the Iran deal and the move of the embassy to Jerusalem. And now they support Netanyahu's crushing of the Palestinians in Gaza. Joining us today to talk about this and also some recent developments with North Korea is Brian Becker. Brian is the national coordinator of the Answer Coalition and a leader of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Brian has been a central organizer of the mass anti-war demonstrations that have taken place in Washington, D.C. and other cities across the United States over the past decade. Brian Becker, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
Well, Michael and I are really happy to have your input because so much is changing on a daily basis, really, with much of our international relations. We wanted to start first with Gaza and Donald Trump supporting Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Although this program is going to air in a week or so, we wanted your thoughts in a general sense about what has happened and the violence that is occurring right now.
And then we'll move on to Iran and then to North Korea.
Right.
This is going to be around the world with Brian Becker.
All right. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. Certainly the massive violence directed against Palestinian people in Gaza. I mean, just consider shooting thousands, more than 1,000 people, wounding more than 2,000 on a single day, killing 60 people with sniper fire, unarmed protesters, and at the same time, we had the Western corporate-owned media images coming back from that area, not really focused on this death and destruction and the massacre and the war crimes and crimes against humanity, but on this gala event of Sheldon Adelson and Ivanka Trump and what was she wearing and posing with selfies with Jared Kushner and the Netanyahus. I mean, it was so gross. It was such a vile depiction of how Western, and specifically the U.S. corporate-owned media, treats American policy towards the Palestinian people. What Israel was doing was demonstrating the unbridled arrogance of power, the fact that the Netanyahus and this very right-wing political establishment in Israel knows that it not only has a blank check from Donald Trump, but it's being egged on to carry out more and more criminal conduct. This is a real, I'd say, a game-changing situation because on display to the world and to the horror of the world were barbarous crimes committed by a well-armed U.S. finance government against unarmed protesters who are coming out not because Hamas conscripted them, but because they're sick and tired and unable to live anymore under the conditions of extreme blockade and occupation.
Brian, I wanted to just elaborate on that point you just made, because the people living in Gaza are in what's been called an open-air prison. Half of them, there's 2 million people there, half of them are children, and 97% of the water there is polluted. A UN report said that it's going to be unlivable in Gaza by the year 2020, and I think that underlies the explanation for their rising up.
Yeah, and the reason they don't have drinkable water, the reason the water is polluted, is that Israel does not want them to have clean water. They do not want them to be able to drink water. They don't want them to be able to get better when they're sick. They don't want them to be able to have jobs. The Israeli government is carrying out ethnic cleansing of massive proportions, and I would say in slow motion, but it's not in slow motion. It's happening with dynamism. And again, U.S. taxpayers are financing this crime.
Brian, I want to ask if you think, looking into the next several weeks or months, given the enormous violence that has occurred in such a short period of time, can there be any positive outcome in the next month or so?
Yeah, I would say no. I would say there will be no positive outcome in the coming period. The two-state solution, which was a fantasy to begin with, that's been crushed. It's been crushed deliberately with the moving of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. It says to the Palestinians of all different tendencies and factions, you're finished. We are going to dominate and crush you. And of course, as a consequence, then, if the Israeli government fails to drive out the Palestinian people, and I think it will fail because in spite of the terrible hardships, Palestine and the Palestinian people will continue to be. They will continue to exist, and they will continue to have the consciousness of a people, and thus they won't be movable. So ultimately, we have a new set of circumstances. If the two-state solution is gone, there will only be one state. And the question is, will it be a democratic state, a state whereby Jews and Muslims and Christians live together in a democratic state, or will it be a vile, racist, apartheid state? That's the only issue on the agenda now. What kind of single, unitary state will exist in historic Palestine?
I think that the demand from all of us has to be that Israel has to lift the blockade. You know, they actually figure out how many calories per day people in Gaza can get and keep them at a starvation level. That place is, I think, the only analogy that I can think of historically. It's like the Warsaw Ghetto.
Indeed, it is. I mean, you know, the irony of history is that the Jewish people, having suffered the genocide of fascism in Europe, have had their legacy and their name and that which they suffered be so horribly manipulated by an occupying colonial power so that it commits atrocities similar to what Jews in Europe experienced in World War II. And I'm not trying to make an exact analogy, but a treatment of occupation and imprisonment and torture and death and destruction from a powerful invading force used these same tactics against the people who they are trying to displace. The Israeli government is trying to displace from historic Palestine. You know, all of us who reject anti-Semitism, reject Islamophobia or hatred of Islam or hatred of Muslims or racism against any people, we have to stand together, as you said, Michael, and absolutely demand the end of this terrible siege on Gaza, just like the Warsaw Ghetto, designed to destroy a people in part or in whole. And if you look at the international definitions of genocide, that's precisely what that says.
And there are so many ways in which we have, as a country, furthered that, including getting the settlement advocate and funder David Friedman to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel.
Indeed. And you have, I mean, here you have Sheldon Adelson, billionaire casino mogul, ultra-rightist, Friedman. You have this whole cast of characters who are basically financing, literally financing the imposition of the U.S. embassy into historic Jerusalem. I mean, that's a violation of international law. Even the UN charter that established the legitimacy of the state of Israel on part of the territory it now controls, that which happened in 1948, made it crystal clear that Jerusalem could not be part of Israel proper, that Jerusalem had a special status, that it was going to be an international city, a neutral city. As the Holy Land for Christians and Muslims and Jews, it would not be under the control of the Israeli state. This in every way is a violation of international covenants, the UN, and a violation of international laws and treaties. Thus, in any treaty, as we know, is the highest law of the land once passed by a two-thirds majority in the Senate and signed into law by the President of the United States. This is a crime. And yet you have private individuals, corporate billionaires, working with the Trump administration and helping to finance this whole entire operation.
And helping to finance the Republican Party. Sheldon Adelson is worth $30 billion and is the major donor to the Republican Party, the Trump wing of the Republican Party. But you also have vulture capitalist Paul Singer. You've got Bernard Marcus, who owns Home Depot. These are the people that fund the Republican Jewish Committee, which is like an extension of Netanyahu's Likud party in this country. And they're the ones behind Trump, and they're the ones that have gotten all these bad policies enacted.
But let's not also let the Democrats off the hook, because Schumer, your senator, the leader of the Democratic Party in the Senate, on the day that Israel was committing this massacre, on the day that Trump's opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, Schumer congratulated Trump. Go for it. You know, I mean, here you have the Democratic Party, the sniveling bunch of imperial cowards embracing Trump at this very moment. Disgusting.
Okay, Brian, on to another topic of equal concern is Donald Trump's denunciation of the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran and the reimposition of sweeping sanctions. What is going to happen to that country with all these changes?
Well, you know, all of the different trends and factions and tendencies in Iran are more or less united right now. If anything, it's brought the country together. Iran was supposed to derive economic benefits from the Iran nuclear arms deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is its technical name. But the fact of the matter is that during the Obama administration, and again under Trump, and with the support of both the Democrats and the Republicans, new sanctions have been imposed on Iran since 2015. And third-party countries, including third-party banks, are fearing that they will be heavily fined and punished and denied access to U.S. markets, haven't really done that much business with Iran. So Iran has not really derived the benefits, the economic benefits it was supposed to enjoy from this deal. So even though, yes, Trump is going to impose new sanctions, I don't think it will make a significant difference on Iran right now, because the status quo has been basically unchanged since the agreement was signed. What I think we are seeing and what we will see is that Trump is setting the stage with Bolton and Pompeo, his war cabinet, setting the stage for a growing overt and covert operation to bring down the Iranian government in the coming years, just as the U.S. did to the Mossack Day, the democratically elected government of Mossack Day in 52 and 53, when it dared nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as BP. The U.S. and Britain did the same. I think that's what the Trump team is planning for Iran. No. I don't think they'll succeed, but I think that's their goal.
Now, Brian, I'm curious about private companies doing business in Iran. Can the European Union or Russia or China do anything to help bail it out?
Yes, I think Russia and China are becoming increasingly closer to Iran. I don't know if it will be a bailout per se, but they certainly will deepen economic integration and economic intercourse between Russia and Iran, China and Iran. The European Union is a different kettle of fish here, because the European Union just issued a fairly strong statement denouncing Trump's leaving of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The British government, Theresa May, Macron, Angela Merkel in Germany, they all want to stay, and they're the signers to the nuclear arms deal with Iran. They all want to keep it going. They're offering right now, as we're recording this segment, the Iranian foreign minister a package of incentives for Iran to stay in the program. But the bottom line is, for the European capitalist countries, will they, if threatened by Trump and by the U.S. Commerce Department and the Treasury Department, threatened with the loss of a U.S. market and access to U.S. credit for trade with the United States versus going forward with Iran, if the U.S. really puts a gun to their head, they're going to say, I believe, they're going to say, yes, we want to be with the United States, not with Iran. So even though they're disgusted by what Trump has done and disagree with it, they're a subservient power, too.
Brian, before we go to our final topic of North Korea, your thoughts on the damage to the U.S.'s reputation from other countries, given these developments?
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. The U.S. government consciously reconstructed the post-World War II world order in the last 2 years of World War II, from 1943 to 45. It included creating the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and all other and many myriad forms of soft American power based on the status of the American government as what they thought would be a sole superpower. That world order also rehabilitated its not only its allies, but its defeated enemies, including Germany and Japan, and made them junior partners with the United States, giving them access to the U.S., to the world market, but as long as they would be sort of junior partners to the United States. What Trump is doing basically is breaking up the post-World War II world order that has served the U.S. empire so well. And as a consequence, I think American soft power and its covert powers will continue to diminish over time, but I don't want to be part of that chorus that says the American empire is fading into oblivion. Far from it. If anything, I think the U.S. is gearing up for a very militarized foreign policy, trying to maintain its position as the dominant force in the world.
Okay, our final topic today, Brian, is North Korea and the threats of canceling talks with Trump. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, North Korea is extremely upset for two reasons right now, and they just last week postponed the North-South summit talks that were the follow-up to the Panmunjom summit between Moon Jae-in and Kim Jong-un that took place on April 27th. They're upset about two things. One, the South Korean government had said, just as the North Korean government said to it, that neither side would carry out provocative acts in the run-up to what they hope to be a successful summit with the United States, leading to a peace treaty ending the Korean War once and for all. The war games that U.S. and South Korea started on Friday include 100 aircraft, including B-52 bombers, simulating the destruction of North Korea. It would only be expected that North Korea would cry foul and say that that's not the way to begin a peace negotiation. And secondly, John Bolton said the model for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula would be the Libyan model, which he oversaw in 2004 during the first Bush administration. Well, of course, to the North Koreans, Libya means a very particular thing. The country gave up its weapons of mass destruction. And then 7 years later, the United States, through NATO, bombed it into destruction, leading to the execution, the lynching of Muammar Gaddafi, the head of state. Why would the North Koreans think about John Bolton as the new national security advisor, advising Trump, who's touting Libya as a model, as someone that they can actually negotiate in good faith with? So they're very upset. And I think they're making it clear to the Trump administration that DPRK is not on its knees. It's not a servile state. It's not scared. It's prepared to walk away if the U.S. empire is not prepared to meet it halfway.
Brian, we've been reading a lot about fears of a nuclear holocaust pushing Americans to stockpile essentials such as food, water, and fuel, and also to purchase potassium iodide pills. I read that this spiked when Trump became president, and it was in the news a few days ago. Aside from coping that way, what is your advice in terms of taking to the streets in protest? What can Americans do to share their discontent with a lot of the developments that we've discussed with you in the last 20 minutes?
Well, you know, I'm a central organizer with the Answer Coalition. There are many other many groups who are working with ANSWER. Our website is answercoalition.org. There's constant anti-war activities, anti-militarism activities. I think it's important for people to become part of organizations. But there's another thing that I want to start with, which is to understand what we're really facing. I mean, it's really important that the American people really have a full grasp. The anti-Russia campaign that's been generated for the past 18 months is also dovetailing with the release by the Pentagon of the National Security Strategy and the Nuclear Posture Review, which says that the U.S. will prioritize preparing for major power confrontation with Russia and China in the coming decade for money spending, for contingency planning, for war planning. Now, that seems like insanity, because it is insanity. But nonetheless, I think if we were to talk to people 2 years before 1914 and said, is it possible that the world will go to war and all the major powers will start killing each other and 20 million people will die in 4 years? Most people would have said, no, that's not possible. That's insanity. But it happened. And 20 years later, World War II happened. And the possibility of this happening again is actually real. And people have to really understand what's going on. So if you're progressive, don't just go along with the Russiagate hysteria. Think about where the Pentagon and the CIA and the military-industrial complex are taking us. People have to start thinking. They have to start reading. They have to be unafraid to stand up to witch hunting. And they have to join anti-war organizations. It's really an urgent moment.
Brian, I have a final question, unless Michael wants to add something. You referenced the military-industrial complex. How much of all of this warmongering do you think really relates to U.S. wanting to support defense businesses and contractors?
I think it's fundamental. It's the ABCs of military spending. You know, when Trump ordered 100 cruise missiles to crash into Syria last month, Raytheon stock went through the roof that morning because there was going to be 100 new cruise missiles, each of them costing $1.5 million. War is great business. It's part of American capitalism. It's a fundamental feature of American capitalism. But it's not just about incentivizing war for business, because once those weapons are built, it's a certain kind of commodity. It can't be eaten, it can't be worn, it can't be used in everyday life. It can only be used in the course of war. And so the incentivizing of war production also incentivizes war, and thus becomes a real danger to humanity. That's why when I say to people, when they say, what should we do about getting rid of the danger of war, we also have to get rid of the danger of corporate capitalism, because the two are so toxically intertwined.
What's going on now with North Korea and South Korea, with Iran, with Gaza, all is reminiscence of the buildup to World War II. World War II just didn't happen immediately. It started in the 30s. And these steps towards Armageddon are happening now. Heidi and I are very grateful to have you, Brian Becker, the head of the ANSWER Coalition on Law and Disorder. And do you have any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
Well, I do want to say this, that, you know, what we see from the people in Gaza is, no matter how bad conditions are, how seemingly impossible the struggle is, people keep fighting, they keep organizing, they keep mobilizing, they keep engaged in self-sacrifice. And that really is the only hope. The only hope for change, as we've seen throughout history, comes when we, in spite of the daunting odds, come together, stand together, be unafraid, and do what we can do as individuals and as groups and as communities, that change can come. And thus, we must remain optimistic, because we must believe in ourselves and our ability to change society.
Brian Becker, Michael and I respect you so much and are so thankful for your joining us today.
It's a great honor. Thank you.
You take it easy, Brian.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Before the Civil War, there were 6 women lawyers in the entire United States of America. By 1890, there were about 200, and by 1900, about 1,000. Women then could not even vote. It was nearly impossible for a woman to get admitted to a law school or find a job when she graduated. Things did not qualitatively change until the late 1960s and 1970s. By then, as a consequence of a number of factors, including the Great Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, and the empty law school seats created by drafting men to serve in Vietnam, women were able to fight discrimination and win law school admission. First by protesting in the streets, and then through legislation, court decisions, and the actions of a few forward-looking politicians. Now, half of the students in American law schools are women. They are professors in those very same places. Indeed, the deans of the two most prestigious law schools in America, Harvard and Yale, are women. They are partners in law firms, hold important positions in governmental agencies, and are judges on the bench. They have made a difference in the measure of social justice obtained by people in this country by advancing people's and women's rights in education, health care, employment, discrimination, family life, and violence against women. Here to speak with us is Jill Norgren, the author of the just-published book, Stories from Trailblazing Women Lawyers. Ms. Norgren is a professor emerita of political science at John Jay College and the Graduate Center, the City University of New York. She is the author of several books, including Rebels at the Bar.
Jill Norgren, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Nice to be here this morning.
How did your project of telling the stories of trailblazing women lawyers come about?
It's a great story. It has two phases. One is the creation of the Women Trailblazers Project, which was created by some of the members of the Commission on Women in the Profession of the American Bar Association. They did a lot of solicitation for funds, came up with the money, and eventually interviewed 100 women lawyers whose careers they felt were exceptional, and also noted for the fact that they were committed to mentoring other women, bringing them along. So they created this fabulous archive database of oral histories that range from about 50 type pages to as many as 500. And right, that's a real accomplishment. And when they had gotten to about 85, they approached me, knowing that I had done work on 19th century American women lawyers, and asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book. And happily, I was no longer teaching and had the time, and I took it on and have worked on it for several years. And here we are with this wonderful book that NYU Press has just brought out.
Speaking of NYU, our own Michael Smith here began NYU Law School back in 1964. At that point, 10% of the class were women. Mm-hmm. And the school made a big deal about that. Back then, women could be teachers, nurses, librarians, but not many lawyers. Now, half of the classes in law schools are women. Law firms' hiring policies essentially kept women scarce until the 60s and 70s. And then it all changed. Right. How do you describe that phenomenon?
Right. Well, it's a terrific story, and it's an example, I suppose, of what several years ago we were all calling the perfect storm. The coming together of about five or six factors that by the very end of the 1960s permitted women who had really wanted to be in the profession of law to get there. So before that, as you said, one of the enormous barriers was getting the education. And women were kept out by both formal and informal quotas. And so, in fact, NYU's 10% was actually on the high side. There were schools in which there might be only one or two women per year. So what was this perfect storm? Well, it begins after World War I. We get increased government funding, state and federal level, for education, higher education. So obviously, before women can go to law school, they need a college undergraduate degree. And there were more state universities because a lot of these women, as we may discuss, were really people from poor working class families. So women could go to schools that were expanding, get their undergraduate degrees, and then be in a position, as the law schools opened, to apply. The second factor that I think contributes in an important way to women beginning to enter the field of law is that the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s contributes to the training of men and women of many different backgrounds in leadership. And this is critical because, of course, then we see the unfolding in the second half of the 1960s of the women's movement, where you get all these new demands, you get a new language for talking about things. Separate from that, one of the things that happens is really critical, which may make us laugh now, but we see the in the 60s the attack on laws that prohibited the use of contraceptives. And at the same time, the development of the birth control pill. It's very hard for women to go into a field where they weren't wanted and where one of the primary explanations of why, for example, law firms wouldn't take them was, oh, you know, you'll get pregnant and you'll leave. Well, once you have the birth control pill, women can say, I can plan my life. And so in my book, I have several quotes from women who said, the birth control pill gave me the career I loved. So moving along in this rather long story, we have then finally the impact of the Vietnam War of the 60s and really till 75. And what we had then, which listeners may not recall, is we had a draft. And it meant that men had to, if they were called up, had the possibility of being sent to Vietnam. And that included a number of men who would have otherwise applied to law school. Ergo, empty seats in law school, and law schools don't like the loss of tuition money. And so suddenly these formal and informal barriers to women came down.
Jill, what do you want readers to think about as they're reading this book and after?
Okay, the Stories book, Stories from Trailblazing Women Lawyers, is at one level a story about the women and their families, and I think that's important for people to think about. You know, what was the cost to these people when they had ambitions that couldn't be achieved? What happened when, in the case of one of the African-American women in the story, when a judge turns his back on you when you're trying a case, right? Or sends you out of court because he doesn't like your afro. What happens when you are the number one graduate in one of the most elite law schools in the country and the law school will not send your name forward for an interview to the U.S. Supreme Court, which traditionally was done for the number one student? So first of all, I'd love readers to just think about that. And at the individual level, what's the cost of discrimination? And then what were the phenomenal achievements of these women? Because these are the women who overcame it. It's much harder to go find the women who were defeated by it. So that's the first part. And then the second part, which is Michael and I were talking about a little bit before, is a kind of what if, but I think it's an important what if because now we're trying to remedy it. And that is, what would our country have looked like and what could it look like now if there were more women lawyers? Now, this is not to say that every woman is going to, you know, do progressive, fantastic things, the things that I might want. Women lawyers come in all manner of social and political perspectives. But I can imagine that if there were women at the beginning of the Republic writing the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the various laws that members of Congress and state legislatures write, that our country would have looked different. Our civil law, our criminal justice system, you know, all of that. So as I say, it's a what if, but I'd love readers to close the book periodically and just think, you know, what would this particular issue be like with more women involved? And of course, we've seen this with things like rape law, right? Where you used to have all sorts of corroboration. And so women couldn't get a successful prosecution of their case.
Many of these pioneer women came from poor immigrant families or families with really bad health problems. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I see it as the quintessential American story. You're absolutely right, Michael. Many of these women came came from families that were new to the country. There were a number of women whose families had left Europe as the Nazis took over, people whose parents had survived the concentration camps. There are other women of all backgrounds, all ethnicities and races, who just came from poor families. And they were strivers. And because the United States had a terrific education system, they were able to plug into that, as it were, and get the backgrounds to pursue their ambitions. And if that isn't the American story, what is?
You know, there are so many of these extraordinary women written about in your book. One of them was Constance Baker Motley, mm-hmm. became a judge here in New York City.
That's right.
And our co-founder at Law and Disorder, Michael Ratner, was her clerk.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted you to reflect on her. And then there are another number of other women that you write about in the book, Constance Slaughter Harvey, Marion Wright Edelman. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about these three women.
All right. Well, Constance R. Harvey was one of the trailblazers, the 100 trailblazers. The other women I talk about as role models, people who came before. In the case of Constance Motley, she died just when the project began. So I wanted to write about her, but of course I didn't have an oral history for her. But she's an extraordinary person, born in Connecticut. She talks in her interviews elsewhere about being one of 12 children, again, from a striving Caribbean family. She becomes a lawyer. She works for many years for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Interestingly, at the end, is passed over to be top leader when Thurgood Marshall is chosen instead. She comes back, she bounces back, becomes a state senator here in New York. She comes to the city and I think was city council head for a while. And then in the summer of 1966, Lyndon Johnson, the president, calls her to the White House. She goes down there thinking she's on a short list and for a federal judicial position and she's going to be interviewed. And instead, Johnson, who I write in the book, loves surprises, right? He stands with her for a photo op and he tells her, "I've nominated you to become a federal district court judge." She's the first African-American woman to have that honor. And in that interview, she says that Johnson tells her, "You know, I'm hoping Thurgood Marshall will become a Supreme Court justice. And, you know, keep your eyes open. I think you could follow him." So it's an exciting history.
Constance Slaughter Harvey won many cases in the struggle to enforce the Sixth Amendment so that black people could get a jury of their peers.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for her? I remember reading in your book that she brought some 40 lawsuits on that issue.
Right. She was a Mississippi attorney, and she did all this as a very young woman lawyer in the middle of some of the most violent activity that was surrounding the civil rights movement of that moment. And she goes out there with very little experience under her belt, but she knows what needs to be done, and these jury rights issues are one of them. And she just goes in and she fights. She is one of the people who, in her oral history, you know, talks about her struggle with racist judges, police, but she also talks, and I think this interested me very much, she would work with lawyers, generally white male lawyers coming down from the North to help with African-American civil rights issues and to get them out of jail and so forth. And, you know, she talks about her own personal struggle with being a Southern African-American woman and having some larger sense of what the needs were and having these men coming down from the North telling her what to do. And, you know, there's a real tension in that, of course. These men were coming down, you know, I know some of these people now retired. You know, they felt they were needed and they were needed in many senses. But on the other hand, they were not uncomfortable telling this young African-American woman, "Well, we need to do this or we need to do that." So there's tensions in all directions. And I think emotionally it was very hard for her.
Another African-American woman, Marion Wright Edelman, was mm-hmm. also quite impressive, wasn't she?
She was and is. And again, she's not one of the 100 that were interviewed, but we know a great deal about her, and I wanted to mention her. She also went to the South and was involved in some of the areas that Harvey was involved in, you know, experienced the potential violence and worked on the issues then, and then went on to create an enormously important organization, the Children's Defense Fund. She's really one of the heroines of the late 20th century in terms of women lawyers working and lobbying for, you know, civil rights issues and children's rights.
A longtime National Lawyers Guild member and former president, actually, of the Guild was Catherine Rohrbach.
Mm-hmm.
And she worked in the area of sex education and reproductive rights. Can
That's
you briefly
right.
talk about Catherine?
Right. Katie Rohrbach was one of several women who worked on women's reproductive rights issues. She was one of the older members of the 100 women interviewed. Our eldest member, someone born in 1916, and is still alive. She's, whatever, do the math, 102, something like that. Catherine Rohrbach, I believe, was born in 1920. She graduated from Yale in the late 1940s and experienced the kind of discrimination that so many of the women in the post-war period experienced. And so even though she had good connections and graduated Yale, she ended up in a small practice with one other man who took her on, eventually started her own practice in Connecticut, and just, you know, became one of our leading civil liberties lawyers. She took on folks during the communist scare period in the 50s who said things that the government didn't like. Later in the 60s, she took on as clients a number of black radicals. And at the same time, she was involved in organizing and litigating on behalf of Connecticut Planned Parenthood.
Esther Lardent was known, mm-hmm. quote, as the queen of pro bono. Yes. Can you explain what pro bono is and why her work was so important?
Yes, isn't that, that's a wonderful title that her her colleagues gave to her. She died recently, and hearing from different people, I came to understand that she was much, much admired. She took this issue of pro bono work, which is basically to do work for the good, you know, for the good of the society, without being paid. And there's a tradition of this in most professions, and certainly in the profession of law, where you take cases, and, you know, it may be a small immigration case, it may be a large case that goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, and you handle it without being paid. And what Esther was looking to do was to take the idea of pro bono in law up to another level, which is instead of a sort of scattershot of different law firms saying, okay, we'll free up one lawyer to do two cases a year, Esther organized an initiative in which law firms would sign on and they would commit to ongoing pro bono work. And it's had a very deep effect on the profession.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG, mm-hmm. who at age 82 still sits on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. She, of course, she's very well known. A documentary is about to come out mm-hmm. On her, and there's a feature-length film, actually a Hollywood film, that's mm-hmm. coming out in the fall. But when she started out, she faced considerable difficulties, didn't she?
She did, absolutely. Again, a little bit younger than Katie Rohrbach, but again, you know, facing this problem of law firms who really didn't know what to do with women. And the didn't know what to do with women has several elements. And I'd love to stop a moment before going on and talking about Justice Ginsburg to sort of go through them for people.
Please do.
Yeah. So, I mean, it involved what I said before. Okay, you're going to get pregnant and leave us. Why should we invest in training you? There's that. There were interviews in which people said, judges and lawyers at private law firms said, oh, you know, the guy said, if he hired me, he couldn't take his jacket off and roll up his shirt sleeves. You know, he'd always have to be properly dressed because there'd be a woman in the office. You have that. You have the excuse that, oh, clients wouldn't want a woman lawyer, which actually turned out not to be true at all. Most clients thought women had to work harder and so would be a better representative for their case. So there are all of these different reasons that law firms and judges didn't take women on. And Justice Ginsburg faced that when she came out of school and, you know, was really trying to figure out what she was going to do. And she was also something of an anomaly because she already had a child. And so when she tried to get interviews, people would say, my gosh, you've already got a child. You should be home taking care of her. So, I mean, she finally did get a position and then went on to be hired by Rutgers Law School. She taught at Rutgers for a number of years, and then she was offered a 10-year position at Columbia Law School. And then in that period, she also started the Women's Rights Project of the ACLU. So it all began to blossom in the late 60s and 70s in that transition from Rutgers to Columbia and her ACLU work.
Jill, do you have any examples of really egregious bad treatment of women?
Too many. The one I mentioned before, the number one graduate of Stanford Law School who was not invited to have her application to the Supreme Court submitted. There's one that just really knocked me off my chair. A woman in a prominent Houston firm who was very ambitious, very good at what she did at the firm as an associate. She, of course, hoped to get a partnership. She had one child, came back within a matter of weeks, had another child about a year and a half later, again, you know, didn't lose stride, and was billing at one of the highest numbers in the firm, and the firm was delighted with the amount of money that she brought in, and her clients were delighted with her. When the partnership vote came, she was not voted partnership. And when she asked why, they said, you know, when you had your first child, we thought you would quit and leave and be a full-time mom. And when you didn't do that, we tried to signal you, but you didn't get the signals. And so when the vote came up, we just voted against you. She, I might add, was offered a higher paying job and an immediate partnership at another Houston firm. And one of her clients, who was from a Fortune 500, went to the firm, which was headed up by some actually quite well-known politician, Leon Jaworski, and called Jaworski and the firm a horse's ass. So, but again, this woman describes the emotional toll that it took on her of having been so successful both personally on behalf of the firm and yet not being affirmed by being offered a partnership.
We have just a few minutes remaining, Jill. Mm-hmm. To conclude, do you think that having a fair number of women attorneys has made a difference to our society?
Great question. It's one of the things that the women, the trailblazers, were asked in their interviews. And I would say there's some varying opinion among the women's, but there is also some consensus that both because women and men, at least up until now, were socialized differently, that it does make a difference because women think through issues differently. And as judges, they may respond in particular to sexual harassment, rape, variety, domestic violence cases differently. And so in those ways, they bring a different knowledge and sensibility, a different life experience to their decision makings. And another point which Justice Ginsburg, I believe, has made, and certainly some of the other women in the study, is that what does it look like in a democratic society if you have institutions, be them your legislators, which of course are filled with lawyers, or your courts, that don't reflect 50% of your population? And so regardless of what the women do once they get into their position, the fact that they're there, and as Michelle Obama has said when her portrait was unveiled, you know, that that African-American girls can look at me and see someone they identify with. Well, you know, what happens when you go into a court and you see a woman and you're a woman, you know? Maybe it changes the experience for you. So in a variety of ways, I think we have to begin to think about how important it is to have women in the law.
Professor Emerita,
yes.
Unfortunately,
Jill
Norgren, who's just written Stories from Trailblazing Women Lawyers, Lives in the Law. It's a terrific book. We encourage people to read it. We're so grateful, Jill, for your being on Law and Disorder.
I'm grateful that you gave me a chance to talk about these women this morning. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.